Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to ask the question, does system matter? Specifically, do well-defined moves on the PC sheet encourage bold choices or just narrow options? And what happens when you throw the mechanics out entirely, like in some of our favorite games? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into today's discussion, I'll remind everyone that, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat hosted by Dan and I. We are there to chat with you, and it's open to all of our patrons. And so you can join in by joining our Patreon. Go to patreon.com/wanderingdms, subscribe at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our private Discord server where we host the chat around maybe 10 or 15 minutes after the episode. So please join up, we'll see you there.
We love that part every week. We have some of the best patrons in the world, like our patron Backwius, who's checking in that we are currently live on YouTube, Twitch, and Restream. Paul, we have slightly weird, jagged energy today, and I feel like that may be a result of us going to our private house convention last weekend. Me getting to see a bunch of my best friends that I have only met at this house con and only see once a year. And man, I got to tell you, I come away from that and we're all tired. I get it. I went right back to work on Monday and we had a long day Monday. I wish I could bottle how I feel when I come back. I am relaxed. I am clear-headed. I feel like I can see what people mean for at least a couple days. I bowled better on Tuesday than I normally do. If I could have that as a potion coming out of HelgaCon every year, boy, what I wouldn't give for that.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I love about conventions, big and small, is that they are a place for exchanging of ideas, right? It's a place where I go to learn new things, whether that's, you know, about a new game that's coming out or somebody else's favorite game or just a new technique or a new setting or something, right? It is just this wonderful mixing pot of ideas for me. And this episode, I know, like, I struggled to write the description of this episode. And in fact, wait, can we get this comment from Josh?
Yeah.
Over here. Yeah. Josh is there. There we go. Okay. Yeah. I totally understand. The topic's a little wobbly. And it comes out of me just reflecting back on last weekend's HouseCon and trying to straighten my brain around. Like, I played a bunch of different games and I realized this is going to be very subjective. Let me start with that. What I'm going to say here is highly subjective and about personal taste. But what I realized is I am not a huge fan of Powered by the Apocalypse as a system, right? And there's a lot of games that are based on Powered by the Apocalypse. I've played a few of them. And I was trying to just run through my head of, like, what is it? What is it about this system that rubs me personally the wrong way? And I started, like, listing off some aspects of it. Like, oh, well, maybe it's because it's a highly improvised game. And I go, that can't be true. I love Fiasco. Maybe it's because it has these very unique characters, right? Every character has their own set of moves that's totally different from everybody else. But Max ran this game of Quest, which does the exact same thing, and I freaking loved it. So what is it? What about this system is just not quite hitting home for me? And then I started just thinking about, like, this idea of, like, really, as a player, most of what I have to go on is what's on the character sheet in front of me. So I just started looking at that and thinking about sort of these different styles of games, right? You have games like, say, old school D&D or even my own Fearful Ends, where you have, like, attributes. No, I don't want to talk about Fearful Ends. Sorry. I want to lump Fearful Ends with a different group. In old school D&D, you have attributes and some special powers, right? Some things fighters can do this and magic users can do that. But fighter A and fighter B generally are picking from the same list, right? It's this consistent set of things that a character can do, and they're broad. Well, so anytime I want to do something weird or different, I'm out in La La Land making it up. Then you have skill-based games, and that's like later editions of D&D. And this is where I would put Fearful Ends or Savage Worlds, right? You have these games where, again, there's a bigger list of skills, but they're still universal, right? Even though my character may have access to alchemy and your character has access to, you know, wrestling, those words are still on both of our character sheets. I just have zero in wrestling and you have zero in alchemy, but we still kind of understand each other, right? This, you know, so, and I've argued in the past, and I think folks have read my blog posts possibly where I rail against skills of like, oh, the problem with skill systems is they pigeonhole me. And like, I suddenly see that I have big numbers in these three skills. So everything, you know, I become the person where every problem is a nail because I have a hammer, right? So I'm like, okay, how do I apply these? And you got these games like Powered by the Apocalypse or Quest, where every character is kind of a unique flower, right? Wanderhome falls into this category too. You're picking from these archetypes, and each archetype is just radically different from the next one, and has interesting things they can do, but they're totally different. And you have and then off on the, you know, fully out there in the realm of giant question mark, you have games like Fiasco, which is just, there's no character sheet. I don't know. You get a couple words, relationships you have with the people to your left and right. Good luck. Figure it out. Am I roughly talking about the scale of things that are in your brain, Dan?
Okay. So I didn't know that this episode was going to be a rant about Powered by the Apocalypse. So
rant is over. This is a subjective...
I'm pushing the stuff on my desk a little further away as I think there's a pretty high chance I'm going to get unleashed here and start gesticulating possibly wildly. There's a thing I'm going to come back around. So I've definitely played a couple Powered by the Apocalypse games myself. I feel two or three. I'm scrambling to figure out exactly which ones. I'm pretty sure we've played at least a couple of weeks of Dungeon World. And I also agree that I came away, it's not for me. And I think there's a pretty good chance that I'm going to be like old cranky man on this episode because I want to be polite to the person that brought the game, that organized it. I think part of the sales pitch there is that it's improvisational and the game master doesn't have to do very much work up front. I think is part of the pitch. Now I've done it enough that like there's a game that doesn't hit me. And then at the end, the game master says, and this was based on Powered by the Apocalypse. And I'm like, right. Of course it was. The Brindlewood Bay seemed very attractive to me. And then when I heard that it was Powered by the Apocalypse, I was like, I'm not going to sign up for that at a convention. So that's where I am with
Apocalypse. Yeah. And maybe as we talk about Powered by the Apocalypse, maybe I think rooting ourselves in Dungeon World is probably a good idea because that is the Powered by the Apocalypse game that still has a theme or a setting that is very familiar to those of us used to D&D, right? It is fantasy, dungeon crawling, absolutely that kind of old school feel, right? And again, I just want to hammer this down, right? Because yes, we're probably going to come across very grumpy here, but I want to say, like, I am not saying it's a bad game. I absolutely not. Some people love it, and that's great, but it is not for me. And that's the big question that I've been trying to answer is, why isn't it for me? Because on paper, it looks like exactly the kind of game I would love. So what is it about my personal tastes that don't quite line up with what it's presenting? And I really wanted to lean into this idea of like, oh, well, you know, it's got these moves, right? So when you play Powered by the Apocalypse, what you're really staring at is like maybe two or three pieces of paper on the table that list all the moves. There's probably one or two that are like, here are the general purpose moves that are available to everyone. Right. And I think in like Dungeon World, one of them is like hack and slash, right? You have a hack and slash move, which is just kill stuff. Great. Yeah. But then also you have moves that are very specific to the archetype your character is based on. So if you have like a wizard archetype, there's probably something like, you know, summon creature from magical realm or something like that. I don't know. I'm making this stuff up now because I don't know Dungeon World super well. but it's stuff like that. Stuff that makes your character unique from everybody else. And I definitely, and I will say, like any like any skill-based system. Again, this is my gripe about skill-based systems, and you know, here I am complaining about skill-based systems, and I totally wrote one. right, Fearful Ends is absolutely skill-based. But like, I feel like when you see big numbers in specific subset of things on your page, you immediately are driven, or at least I am immediately driven to like, how do I apply this to every problem in the world? And I think Powered by the Apocalypse encourages you to do this, right? The moves are a little vague, right? And then anytime you're going to perform an action, you're encouraged to say like, well, how does this fit into the context of one of the moves?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So that is a thing.
Okay.
And I'm not crazy about.
All right. I'm just going to say the thing. So in the back of my head, I was like, oh, I'm going to keep this back here and then spring it in the last 15 minutes. I think that games like among the issues with a game like Powered by the Apocalypse, these games that try to embrace the narrative structure of what a story structure is supposed to be, and they wind up injecting the mechanics are more about how do we manage the narrative flow and structure and less about what's actually happening in the game world. So you wind up getting, for me, very restricted with this list of like, you know, it's my turn to speak or something like that. And I have a move and I have 3 points I can use on moves or something like that. And in addition to, as a couple people in the chat right now, like another Eric said, it might be that there's a layer of abstraction between me and the actual game world. And I totally, thank you for putting that on screen, Paul. I totally agree with that. And you wind up, and I think I've become more sensitive to this, frankly, in the last year or two, is that you wind up talking, right? The literal words that you use at the table to talk about what you want to have happen in the game is not the same thing that your character is thinking about. So if I'm playing D&D and I draw a sword and I charge somebody, that's exactly the visceral experience that my character is going through. And the in-game words are exactly what I'm saying at the table, and I'm very close to my character. But if I start having to talk about things like beats or moves or a climax or the A-B structure to a story or something like that, or I'm filling pieces of my plot wheel, and when my plot wheel's complete, then I can unlock a something, and I can own a scene or something like that. That is not remotely what my character is thinking, and I am routinely perplexed that people don't see that that's degrading the role playing. As far as I can tell, it's degrading me immersing myself in the world and feeling what my character feels, because I'm just not talking about anything that is on my character's mind.
Let's. I want to explore that concept of immersivity a little bit, or immersiveness. Immersivity. Yeah. That's what. Yeah.
Immersion.
Okay. Immersion. Right. The feeling of immersion. I want to talk about that a little bit because it's interesting to me. Because I would say in Fearful Ends, I do try to pull away a little bit from immersion, at least in effect of the top level statement. One of the first things I say to players when they sit down to Fearful Ends is that we recognize that failure is inevitable, and we play to watch our characters fail and delight in that, right? So it is encouraging a separation of character from player, because if you were like 100% immersed, right? And then I start thinking about like 100% immersed as being like close to like basically method acting, right?
I am
my character. Then like what's happening in Fearful Ends would be deeply depressing. But that's not the feel of Fearful Ends when we play it, right? I feel like when we play Fearful Ends, often there's a lot of humor, right? There's a lot of joy, frankly, around the table and laughter at the foibles of the ridiculousness of what's happening to our characters. And we love it, right? We delight in the failures, right? There's a Schadenfreude aspect there of delighting in the failure of the character, because I recognize the character is not me, right? The character is the character.
Yeah,
I am not the character.
Yeah, I mean, if you had a camera on me, I think you would get quite a lot of shots of me scowling and banging the table and being upset, to the great enjoyment of the other players. honestly, But you know, yeah, that's a good example of, to me, it feels like of framing what the game's going to be about. And I'm not the number one. I played in your Fearful Ends game a couple days ago. I'm not the very first person to sign up to a lot of horror games. That was like my one selection for this year at our house convention. I will say that aside from that, Paul, with Fearful Ends, what Fearful Ends does not have is it doesn't otherwise have a whole bunch of narrative mechanics. So that having been said, you don't have like, oh, it's this player's scene to organize. It's not this person's plot point vector, something, something, right? Everything is very concrete that matches the game world. So if someone has a gun, you can talk about, well, this is like a 45 revolver specifically. Do I have bullets for that? That's a very concrete thing. The character sheets have, if I want to know if my character is strong or fast or whatever, you know, the abilities say whether you're, you know, you've got brawn, you've got, you know, dexterity. That's something that you would actually talk about. And the, what do you call them? Benefits or feats? What am I trying to say here for each character?
Perks.
In Fearful Ends. Fearful Ends. Perks. Okay. The perks are very in world, right? And they're loose. They're not... what is the word in software that's suddenly failing me? They're not innately tied together. They're high cohesion and low coupling. They're lowly coupled. Okay. So if last weekend my character was high tolerance to pain. Okay. There's no mechanic for pain that I have to look up. It's not directly like some other mechanic. Like I understand pain. I understand tolerance and I understand what high tolerance is. I can sit down at Fearful Ends and I don't need a bunch of background mechanical understanding to get the gist of what this character is good at. I'm going to say I'm highly resistant to pain. Does that help me out here? And you, the ref, are going to say either yes or no. So I feel that the stuff that's on the sheet is very much in the same words as what the characters themselves would say. And in that respect, I feel that Fearful Ends keeps me really pretty close to the character. And we're not talking about these narrative structure, the scene flow type stuff. That's not part of Fearful Ends, unless I'm missing something.
That's great. I have a bunch of thoughts on that, but I want to put a pin in that and just go back to, because you just said so many things that I wanted to react to. Let me start with this. Like you mentioned, if there was a camera on you during Fearful Ends, you would be like banging the table and frustrated and angry a lot. And what I'm curious about is it fun? Is that enjoyable for you? And would the camera pick that up because you, Dan, are frustrated or because you're leaning into the KFAB?
You know, we had a conversation. We had a brief conversation about this in the car driving away, right? And there was a little bit of difference of opinions, but there was some talk about, like, over the years, Dan has convinced me that games aren't entirely just about fun, and so that's one of my guiding principles there. I it's not something that I'm thinking about most of the time. I like a challenge. I like a challenging game, and oddly, I enter your Fearful Ends games as usual, like saying we all know now. We say Dan's trying to win the game, despite what Paul said at the top. I'm trying to win the game. I appreciate a challenge. I feel like I'm being tested and deepened by that challenge, and I appreciate that. I also know that if I twist it a little bit higher, it's going to entertain other people, and I'm happy to do that. So,
great. Yeah, the funny thing is, I was talking. I can't remember at some point during the convention, I was having this conversation with folks, and I feel like saying that Dan is out to win Fearful Ends isn't quite enough of the picture, because I feel like if you're out to win Fearful Ends or any horror game, then the correct answer is don't engage. Right? Run away, retreat, do not engage with what's happening, turtle up, right? And that's, that will increase the survivability of your character and it will make for a very boring game. So I think if I can, for our viewers, I think that while Dan does want to win at horror games, he wants to win in a way that is still authentic to the character, right? He still wants to embody the character and engage with the world and do things that are authentic to that character. even though those may run counter to winning.
You know, let me say what happened. You know, let me reflect a little bit on what happened in your game last weekend. I did wind up running away, right? My character absolutely did wind up running away, and eventually. I was trying to be true to what would this person that has another job, frankly, do in this case. And I bent a little bit. I could see that the story wanted to take the group to a more dangerous place, and I could see both that was kind of what was developed, and also that's what the other people at the table were interested in. So I did find an excuse, right? I did a little bit of labor on my part to find an excuse why I was frankly driving a bus, right? I was actually the bus driver, you know, taking everybody to different locations. So I did find an excuse of why my character would drive everybody into an even more dangerous area. And then when things got completely supernatural, then I grabbed the bus and ran off by myself, frankly. So I was doing a little bit of work, and I was like, I hope that me running at the end isn't a drag on this game, frankly, but I was trying to find a middle ground of kind of trying to serve both. Yeah.
I think running away is perfectly valid in any horror game. And in fact, one of the mental stress cards is, encourages it, I think, right? I can't remember which one it is, but maybe,
right.
You know, yeah. Anxiety, yeah. So there's one maybe? That actually that encourages you to run away. But it's also about pacing, right? It's about understanding, like, okay, you know, in the first hour is not the time to run away. But mm-hmm. like towards the end of the game, yes, run away is a good option.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that you did
it's
that.
It's not something we ever talk about, right? We never, at the game, talk about, like, this is the third beat and now it's time to run away. It's just, we're kind of trusting. I mean, you've got it built into just the way that the mental stress cards build up. You, the referee, are dealing them out at a certain pace to control that. And we're kind of trusting the players at the table that we're going to work as a team to generate a generally good time without a whole bunch of narrative structural elements trying to yoke us in that direction.
Yeah. Finding a way for your character in an authentic way to engage in what the group wants to do, even though your instinct is this is not what's best for my character. I think that is masterful play. So well done.
Okay.
And then I want to come back to the concept of pacing, because I feel like the where we get annoyed at that kind of like narrative structure terminology is a pacing problem. And I'll illustrate this by comparing it to Fiasco, which I adore. I don't know if you've played a lot of Fiasco, Dan. I think you've played it at least a couple
times, maybe three times.
I adore Fiasco. I'm not sure where you land on it, Dan. And definitely in Fiasco, there is some of that, right? Like every turn, right? You say, I'm going to construct a scene and we're going to see blah, 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 blah. But the reason I think it works in Fiasco is because that is totally separate from the play, right? There is, now we talk about structuring the scene, now we play the scene. Now we talk about structuring the scene, now we play the scene. The scene is never interrupted by the discussion of the narrative structure.
Yeah. This is legit. This is legit.
And so I think that was what makes that enjoyable for me. I still enjoy it because the pacing always feels good. And I think that's maybe where a game like Powered by the Apocalypse fails for me a little bit, is that the pacing is interrupted constantly. Right?
Yes.
Like, oh, what are you going to do? Yes, okay, now I have to interrupt the pacing to engage with the mechanics and talk about structure.
Yes, yes, yes. And let me say, I mean, we've played Fiasco on the show at least once, if not twice. So viewers can go back, dig up when we've done an actual play of Fiasco here and check in whether I was okay with it or not. Whether I started complaining bitterly in the middle of Fiasco, whether I liked the mechanics or not. I don't remember. Now, at the moment, I don't remember what happened that particular session. One of our friends likes to, you know, try new, maybe indie games. And a couple of weeks ago, they pulled out a legal game, like an improvisational, you're going to do a courtroom trial game. And that, just like six pages of rules someone had typed up. And it was like so many intricately coupled narrative type things of like, so there's a witness on the stand and you're going to be asking them questions, and they can talk, but they also have five special moves. They can reject the thing, or they can reveal a key, which is like, I guess, a secret of another character, or they can force an objection and the judge has to do this. And then every time you use one of these moves, you fill up one of the pieces of pie of your plot wedge. And then once the plot wedges are all filled up, something happens. And I'm flipping through all these things. None of it's really in game. You know, the keys, the this, the that, the connections. And yes, exactly that. So in the middle of a scene, you have to go, well, at this point, I use my move to deny a thing which causes a key, which makes a plot point, something. And that was not for me. That is really dragging me down. And I think that with Fiasco, it's relatively lightweight. There isn't like seven pages of rules that you need to digest first. And I think that's a good point that, yeah, there's like, we're setting up different scenes, but within the scene, the mechanics aren't jumping up and interrupting us all the time. I think that is really critical. I agree with that.
Let me compare to another game that I was surprised to discover that I really enjoyed, which is Max ran a game using the quest system. First of all, Max runs games whose settings and themes are just so unusual and generally filled with humor that that's just fun, and I don't care what he's using. But I found myself
Let me interject and say that I played in Max's home game with Quest for better part of a year. I think we played probably about at least great. 6 to 8 months, I think, of Quest. Yeah.
So you may be great. So I can bounce some thoughts off of you here, because I think this is my first real time of like playing Quest. So maybe you'll have a better context for this. But basically in Quest, right, your core mechanic is just roll a d20, and it's not tied to your character in any way. Right. And it gives you a scale of results, right? Anywhere from like complete failure and complete success to like maybe a qualified success or whatnot. But it is just a straight die roll. I'm trying to do a thing, roll the die. It dictates how successful or whether or not it's a qualified success, or I can't remember what the lands between like abject failure and qualified success.
Yeah, I think like 13 is a success and 9 to 12 is partial or something is.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, So that's the core mechanic, right? And then otherwise you're just storytelling, you have a character. But then your character is based on some kind of archetype, right? Or in Max's case, he wrote a whole bunch of custom characters for us. And they each have their own special powers. Usually which involves using a resource called adventure points. Spend these adventure points, do this thing. And sometimes it says, spend these adventure points, roll the die. And you still use the same table of success or failure, but it gives very specific things. So in my case, I was playing a robot who had a huge database of all the data about the world. He was called LibraBot, but the data was poorly organized, to say the least. So I had a couple moves, or a couple powers. Let me call them powers, or I can't remember. There's a term. Quest uses a term for these. I can't remember what they are. Abilities? Something. Anyway. I had a couple of these special powers that were... One was the ability to look up information in my database. Abilities, great. So I had one ability to look up information in my database. I basically could pose a question about the world and roll the die, and the die would indicate how accurate or inaccurate that information was, but the GM would answer the question to give me the information I was looking for. And the other one was called collate the data, in which case it was very similar, except that I could just make up something about the world. I can make up a fact about the world, and the die would indicate how correct or incorrect I am. But at the high levels of success, I'm just saying something about the world, and it is now true. Right, so it's giving me this ability to impact the world and whatnot. And then I think I had some third ability that was maybe combat related. So the fun thing about that was, why am I bringing this up? I was just trying to give an example of how Quest operates, right? But like in my brain, that feels kind of similar to what a character sheet in Powered by the Apocalypse looks like, right? They have special moves that are unique to that character. And then there's some core moves that are generic across the world. But that core mechanic is so trivial. It's so nice. And my abilities, like you were mentioning, Dan, are all rooted in the world, right? My robot is literally accessing his database, right? This is a thing that the robot should and can do, right? And it makes sense.
Yep.
for me to talk about, oh, I'm accessing my database. Give me a moment while I read and collate the data. And I guess the nice thing about the special abilities is they weren't so forefront in the things that I was doing in the world that I felt like I constantly had to find ways to use them. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was limited. I could only use them so many times because of the adventure points. So I was saving them for special occasions.
Yes.
Right. And yeah, so I wasn't constantly engaging with that mechanic. I was reserving it. And generally, I would just do things and roll the die and stuff would happen. Or I would just talk to the DM and maybe I didn't have to roll the die. We would just talk about what happens. And I just found that really, really nice. I really enjoyed that. And it kept me engaged and in character. And I never felt like this restriction like I did in a Powered by the Apocalypse game that I was playing over the weekend, where I'm staring at the sheet of moves and I'm just constantly thinking, how do I use these moves? Possibly because in Powered by the Apocalypse, there is no way to do a thing that's not a move, really, right?
Exactly this. Right. You have to engage with this narrative level abstraction for everything, allegedly, right? The way it's written, everything has to be there. And I agree. So when we were playing Quest, I think for a couple months I was playing a Ranger. And then for a couple of months, I was playing Wizard in that time. And I'm as you're talking, I'm actually pulling up my character sheets to remind myself, because this was a couple years ago at this point, maybe as much as 3 to 5 years ago, I'm seeing. And totally that. So, you know, the Wizard, I feel like a point that I want to make is that, you know, having specialized, you know, game-breaking mechanics makes more sense for fantastical things, right? If there's just mundane action with like a D&D fighter that we as players just understand how things are kind of supposed to work in the world, as far as can you ride a horse, how much food do you need, is a battle axe dangerous, this kind of stuff, you can kind of reason it on out on your own. But when you start doing more fantastical esoteric stuff that's actually breaking the reality, you definitely need some kind of better defined mechanics of what the scope of that is. So for me, playing a wizard, like in Quest, right, my abilities are magic strike, telekinesis, last light, pull up a familiar, things like that. That makes sense. Those are in the world, right? They're fairly concrete, and I need rules to manage that kind of stuff. And then even the ranger abilities are also immediately supernatural. So the very first ability for a ranger in Quest is commune, right? And there's magical folk song that affects people's emotions. There's speak a myth. There's, you know, remedy to do healing that normal people can't do. So I like the fact that, again, all those words, if I say I use remedy, we know what it is. I don't have to say I use a move for resuscitation and my ability is remedy. Like, I'm remedying something. And I need that mechanic because it's kind of fantastical and kind of supernatural. And nonetheless, all the words that we're speaking at the table are actually what the character would potentially say. So I agree that the abilities there never bothered me in Quest. I will say, look, something does irritate me about Quest. I am a little weirded out by the 1d20 roll that's always the same success levels. That surprised me. That actually is not my preference. You know, I'll say, look, you know, I wish that, you know, some characters would be stronger and some characters would be weaker at different things. Seems natural to me. And I'll say, look, I'm currently running a Star Frontiers, you know, campaign. And I guess one thing that would be weird to late edition D&D characters is that, yeah, you have fairly broad skills. So you have a skill of like medicine. Okay. And that covers a whole bunch of it. It covers surgery and diseases and diagnoses and a whole bunch of stuff with quite a lot of detail to those kinds of things. And you also have your character ability scores like in D&D. And the thing is, in Star Frontier, in classic Star Frontiers, they don't interact in any way. So if I have a really high reason score, or a really high logic score, that actually doesn't affect my chances to succeed at surgery in any way. And in some cases, that surprises players. It simplifies things a lot. It simplifies my calculations that I can just go, surgery is at this level is always this percentage, and I don't have to modify it with an ability. So on the one hand, I guess I can respect simplifying that kind of stuff. And I do think for me, Quest went a little bit too far on that angle. But the abilities, abilities on the ship, that never bothered me.
Yeah, having only played it as a one shot, possibly my view is limited, and so like, yeah, I would think that probably the thing that is missing is some feeling of progression, especially if you're playing in a fantasy adventure setting where we're used to like leveling up and such. But I mean, I would hope. I guess I don't know Quest well enough. Does Quest have
about
some
Quest? Form? You're talking about, yeah. Well, I was just about to ask you like what level you were at. So as you proceed, I think they call them adventure points, I think, which is equivalent to XP. You'll get like two or three, and you can spend those to buy additional powers in this hierarchy of powers. And so we were, the character sheets that we would get would be like about 7 pages, and we were trying to get up through these tiers. And on the last page, there are these legendary abilities. And we were just, I think right at the end of one of our games, I managed to level myself up through the powers, you know, and there's not many, there's like maybe 20 on the whole list for a character, I think. And I managed to level up and get an ability for my wizard called Last Light, I believe, which was basically like a Death Star laser. Just like, this laser burns through anything, period, the end. And I'm like, yes! Thank you!
Okay. Yeah, it's good to know that exists.
That was a big part of it.
I only have this
I thought it worked
one
well.
Game for my reference. That's interesting. I actually really like the elegance of the magic, the special one role that is not tied to your character and in any way, because I feel like if you played it for a while, people just internalize the numbers, and now like you never have to ask, you never have to add, just grab the die and roll and like just look at the number and I know what's going to happen. I think there's something elegant and fun about that to me.
Max could never remember what the partial success range was. Max is such a great referee. I feel bad. I should ignore that. I cut that out. We're going to cut that out of the show later. I shouldn't have said that.
Yeah, well, if there was
editing. We were all there to help each other. We got through it. It was fine. Great. It was perfectly fine.
Let me go out on a limb here and make a crazy assertion here and tell me if this tracks for you or not, Dan. So what we're talking about that we don't like in a mechanic like a heavy moves mechanic like Empowered by the Apocalypse is the nature of it to break our immersion by making us constantly engage in this language that has nothing to do with the world that we're involved in. Is this potentially the same reason you and I are not huge fans of the latest edition of D&D?
Okay, if you talk 5th edition, 5.5, whatever edition you need, the very first thing that I want to say is I don't like action points. What are they called? Inspiration. The very first thing, I get it, you know, I play D&D 5th edition, I get the PC sheet really close to the top, there's a space for inspiration, don't like it. Bothers me right off the bat.
Likewise, there's a lot, right? Like a lot of people talk about the build of their character, right? And they talk about like what abilities they've come. And then a lot, right? You say like, okay, well, I don't know. Like if I'm brand new to the system, I'm looking for the, you know, and especially if I'm rooted in old school D&D, I'll say, well, I'll play the easy character type. I'll play the fighter. But no, they're not less complex than the magic user. They have just as many abilities. Exactly. And they start using like, you know, fancy action dice, right? That you're, tracking right. Is that so? Is it the same thing? Right? Is this like great? So it's not making us speak in narrative terms, but it is making us speak in a game mechanic term that has nothing to do with the real world.
Well put. Yep. And I did play a fighter, and I wanted to play well. I wanted to win, so I learned a battle master or something like that. And I leaned into the whole, I got this many dice to spread out on my abilities during the day, and this ability, I'm going to use 3d8s and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. You're spending a lot of time talking out of character, out of world. And, I wish I was playing a classic D&D fighter.
Yeah. Again, I want to note, right? So there's some comments in the chat that we're getting spicy here, right? But I want to underscore that we're talking about personal preference here. We're talking about taste. And this is always an interesting conversation for me to have, because I'm not saying that these games are bad or wrong or they're doing it wrong or you shouldn't play them. But what I do really personally enjoy is investigating my own tastes and the tastes of the people that I play with, so that I can hone in on the games that are going to work really well for us. And that's to the point of like, I've had conversations with Had a conversation with my partner Tanya when we first started role playing together, where I quickly evaluated that she doesn't like crunch, and she didn't. She wasn't aware of that word, and I had to explain to her what crunch is in a game.
Okay.
I said, like, I kind of like one of the things I really like about gaming is kind of being the gaming sommelier who figures out what would this table of people really enjoy. And I think you have to have these conversations to figure that out.
And Paul's great at that, I will point out. Paul's very thoughtful about exactly that and is very, you know, just great at exactly that. You know, whereas I might tend to be like, you're going to learn D&D, buddies! ladies and gentlemen, you're going to learn classic D&D, whether you like it or not. And, you know, let
one
me say,
the
so classic
been...
D&D... Let me, okay, and let me talk about, on that point, I'm going to teach you about classic D&D, kids. So I really like if you really minimize, you know, classic D&D down to fighter, thief, wizard, like I like to do with our OED rules, I the best thing in the world, particularly for a new player, is original D&D fighter or, you know, BX or first edition. They're so close to each other. We all agree they're great. Give them a, you know, first level fighter. And just go, you've got this equipment, right? These are your abilities. Is what can you do with a sword and a dagger and a rope and a shield and a helmet? That's it, right? You imagine what the world is like, and you imagine being creative about just surviving in this situation. And I feel like that's the essence of it. And that's the case where you don't need to know any rules of D&D in order to engage with that. And I'm almost at the point where I almost want to ask some people, like, that are new players, like, do you like math or not? And if they say no, I'm just like, I'm going to roll all the dice for you, maybe.
Yeah. Interesting.
And then
interesting.
Once you're comfortable with that's really the substrate of what our role playing should be, is you imagine what you want to do in the world. Then maybe you can level up to the thief class that has about half a dozen specific esoteric skills, and if you were to push me and say, how likely is it that you actually pick a lock or pick a pocket in my life? I've never engaged with that. I need some kind of rules to outline what's reasonable for that, because frankly, off the top of my head, I don't know. So you get that. And then at some later point, if you do like crunch and you're happy with that, then you can go and play a wizard, and you're going to have to grab, book of spells or something like that, or a rule book, literally flip through, understand what your spells do, and engage with the mechanics at a more crunchy level. And I love the fact that classic D&D maybe accidentally supports these different hierarchies of engaging with crunch. And when you get to something like fourth edition, which said very explicitly, all the classes must have interesting special abilities, so that for every wizard spell, there's got to be a fighter move and have complete equity with that. Boy, I personally, my subjective take is that was a huge misfire. That was a huge, huge, huge misfire. And I know there's many of our close friends that love fourth edition D&D, but taking away the capacity for a class that's entirely mundane and entirely something you can talk about in real world terms with, and require every new player to engage with these out of game mechanics, to me, that was a huge loss.
Yeah, I could see that. I'm resisting the urge to go down the road of beating up on fourth edition, even though I've already beat up on PBTA and fifth edition.
I feel good about that.
You know, so I want to go back, like, one thing I want to dig into is one of the things I found really interesting about introducing my partner, Tanya, to role-playing games and trying to get a feel for her tastes as she engages with them more is very early on she said things like, well, I don't like dungeon crawls, right? At the moment a game has the word dungeon crawl in it, she's like, no, that's not for me. And I really wanted to explain why. What is it about a dungeon crawl that is specifically bad? And is it the mechanics? Is it because your only experience was doing that in a fifth edition D&D game? And, like, would you enjoy it in an old school game? And she did play in, I played an OD&D game over during our house convention last weekend. It was WDMO2. So everybody knows what I'm talking about, right? Because you watched that episode or you have the PDF. If not, go check it out.
I was there.
but it is a first level OD&D adventure exploring a cave filled with ice bees with the goal of stealing some royal jelly, which is fascinating. And one of the most delightful things to come out of that play is that she and another player both just really loved the bees. They were like, this is adorable and cute and wonderful, and we like the bees and we want to be friends with the bees. And I was like, that's okay. Well, it's not really the way the adventure was built, but okay, right?
Yeah.
And you can kind of engage with it that way a little bit until, like, the queen, you meet the queen and you realize the queen is not, mm-hmm. not a friendly character. But they did, even though it was like exploring a dungeon, there was still a lot more of like engaging with the environment and trying to figure out what the bees wanted and maybe not necessarily attacking them on sight and finding ways to it not provoke the bees, right? So they did a lot of these things very mm-hmm. successfully, frankly. Still came away with that a little bit of like, I don't know, it was a little dungeon crawly. And she felt bad, right? That ultimately there was no option to be like, we're just going to befriend the bees and just, you know, They're nice, kind, and wonderful, and right. And maybe that did it. Maybe I wasn't being flexible enough because maybe I should have had an ability to like go to the queen and like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
negotiate or something, right? Instead of just stealing from her, instead of the queen just being horribly aggressive. Though the queen, by the, if you read the adventure, of course, the queen wants to enslave people, right? Like the queen is used to being a queen bee who wants slaves to work for her. So obviously that kind of runs counter to a lot of people's sensibilities. The end result, Dan, is as I was trying to contemplate, is OD&D good or not good for the tastes of someone like Tanya? The next test I want to put her to is she needs to play Outdoor Spoliation.
Oh, geez.
I feel like that's the next, right? Because that's OD&D, but it's not, you're not in the dungeon, you're exploring an open world, and there's more ability, more like gray area, or, right, like it can and has turned into just like ransack the countryside, but it doesn't have to, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And for viewers who don't know that we use the term outdoor spoliation when I take original D&D 1974 and I use the wilderness rules. Let's say go grab the outdoor survival map because that's part of your acquired equipment, and just use the monster tables, basically. Plus, there's some castle tables to see what you run into. When I run that, I go into it. I don't know what's going to happen. There's definitely no plot, and I am so frightened. I've never been so uncomfortable going into a session. And, you know, some are better. Some sessions are better and some are worse, of course. Interesting.
It's basically a classic hex crawl, right? With the one difference, which you can describe, may or may not be consistent with how people play D&D, of that the hex map is a visible board to everyone out on the table, mm-hmm. right? I feel like, if you just read the D&D source books and like try to implement a hex crawl, it maybe is implying that you have a hex map that's secret, right? And the players are figuring it out. Similar to way a dungeon crawl.
Yes.
But in this case, not so much because it's just on the table. And now I'm kind of kicking myself when we had Bill Webb here that we didn't dig into hex crawls more, because I'm pretty sure that's like a major component of the booklet that we got handed of the preview of his upcoming game is hex crawls.
Necromancer's game.
Part of that. Yeah. Yep. So, but I feel like that, like,
right.
Again,
now, the viewers, just to be clear, the viewers are experiencing time reverse of what we are.
Time reversed?
Yeah. So for us, that was in the past, and for them, that's in the future.
Oh, dear. I forgot about that. I'm so sorry. I forgot all about that. That's right. Due to timing constraints, that episode was not aired live. It was recorded and has not actually been posted yet. I apologize, viewers. You're like, what the hell are they talking about? Yes, that's in the future. I'm speaking of the future, of course. Oh, goodness. Wow. That is... We don't often pre-record episodes like that, but we've done it once this year, and we will do it again for the Bill Webb interview. Again, just because we want to talk to these people on our show, and they're just, some people are just not available in mid-Sunday afternoon. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, so that's where
pretty
we
busy,
end up. So, apologies, viewers, for Yeah. Anyway, look forward to that. There is lots of exciting things to talk to him about his upcoming game, the Necromancer's game. Unfortunately, X Pulse will not be one of them.
And yet it's a major part of the book. So yeah, we should have.
And yet it is a major part of the book.
You know, well, it's funny because when when you mentioned your partner Tanya, I was thinking, you know, my partner Isabel sometimes resists, but we got her in a big weekend game a couple of years ago, going through Janelle Jacquet's classic Caverns of Thracia. And she was so enthusiastic about that. She was so enthusiastic about like a weekend long limited scope. She doesn't want to commit to like a years long campaign, but a couple days actually of really focused dungeon crawling D&D sessions. And one of the things I remember in that session was when they got a map, they got a partial map to the complex, and all of a sudden the whole party, all the players could engage in strategizing about where to go next. And can we get some clues? What do we think's down this way versus what do we think's down that way? Would it be more valuable to go here? Can we get information and then turn around? And the play really changed dynamically, much in the same way that having the outdoor survival map, which is literally the background to our show every week, that we're all looking at right this very second, having the outdoor survival map in the open and allowing people to engage with what's in different options, different directions, changed the play very similarly. So, you know, throwing down a partial dungeon map had similar, grabbed more people, I guess, into the action that normally might not say they love dungeon crawling so much.
Dan, I don't know if we've had a topic about this or not, but I can think of, off the top of my head, three or four examples very quickly of games where the players up front are handed a map, whether it's complete or incomplete. Right? It happens in Hangman's Hill. It happens in Dyson's Red Swamp. It happens in, it happens in Palace of the Vampire Queen, right? There's a player map that is incomplete, but it exists, and I think that those games are actually super fun, and I strongly recommend playing a game where the players have a either complete or incomplete map of what it is they're exploring. I think it's, if we've not done a topic on that, we should. I'm resisting digging into it right now because we have like less than 10 minutes left in the show, which is definitely not enough time to explore that.
that's another day. So on the point about do we like more defined skills on the character sheet? I was reflecting briefly on the two games that I ran myself last weekend, and one, I was running the classic tournament adventure, it's for AD&D, Shrine of Tamawakan, and I was running with slightly lower level characters. Oh, fantastic. Thank you for pulling it up. I was running it with fourth level characters with a larger party size than it's really written for. And at that level, right, so again, fourth level, you don't have fireball, you don't have super world-breaking things, and so a lot of the action was these very mundane, right? Very in the world, very immersive. How are we going to survive down this next horrible tunnel? And there was, you know, characters were using spears to probe the dangerous underwater room underfoot for where it was going to drop off. They were using a mirror to scan for traps and hidden objects, maybe. They were, someone got up and actually pantomimed how they're going to very carefully walk through the water and the mud to avoid falling down and things like that. And I really love that, and I'm trying to honor these things by making it safer if that's what they're doing or giving them more information. There's no rule in classic D&D about how to use a mirror. There's nothing in the rules saying you're allowed to take a rope and tie it around your water skin and then use that as a probe to throw into the deep water. But all this stuff was happening. We weren't getting tripped up by out of game language or narrative structure. And that's what I love about D&D. And then on the other hand, you know, when I ran my Wizard War Game session, which is the highest level, it kind of looks something like this, which is the highest level wizards and all the spells in classic D&D. Okay, now, you know, the spells, again, they're fantastical. They're not something you can just reason out entirely. So yeah, we need a specific list of the spells that you've memorized and specifically what they do in the game. And that game is not 100%, but that game is a lot about what spells are in my repertoire right this second, and what would be the best spell to use to try to counter somebody else's ability. And a lot of it was looking at the discrete list of powers that we call our wizard spells. And I'm perfectly fine with that. The game is admittedly a little bit more wargamey and a little bit less role play, but I'm also perfectly fine with that. So I don't think I would have said this until you brought up this very topic today, Paul. But yeah, I mean, classic D&D has this nice kind of scaling, you know, sliding scale that you can actually dial that in a little bit, partly at the different levels. And the last weekend, I got to kind of play with both, and they kind of work. They kind of both work, frankly. But it's still all in world, right? If someone says, I cast teleport, their character is actually casting the magic words for teleport. They're not using an action beat in order to advance the plot. And I really, that's the kind of gaming that I prefer.
Dan, we are out of time. So, final thoughts on, I don't even know how to wrap this whole time.
did we burn Powered by the Apocalypse?
Go back to the title. What was the title of this thing? Powers, Moons, and Skills.
There was debate. Yeah. I like the fact that classic D&D has this sliding scale. Fighter, none of that. Thief, a little bit of that. Wizards, a whole bunch of that. And I like that it's not required. It's not required in classic D&D. I like that the game works entirely just reasoning about the mundane world. I like being a little bit more immersed. I like the language at the table to reflect the language that the characters would be using. To me, that's the kind of the essence of role-playing, of feeling what it would be like to be in the situation. And me, I like neither out of game language, nor is my subjective preference for narrative structure wrangling. And yeah, if you take the example of Powered by the Apocalypse, it does both. So not the game for me.
Interesting. I would still stand by my argument that like a very long list of specific powers, abilities, skills, what have you, especially when you can see based on the character sheet, I'm good at these and not good at those, that they have a tendency to focus the play into how do I leverage these stats, abilities, powers, what have you, rather than approach the world in an immersive way of just, I am the person in this world and I can act and do whatever I want. So I enjoy powers and abilities, but I want them to be counterbalanced by also some generic standardized mechanics of how to interact with the world that are very open-ended. And I mean very open-ended. Like I think Quest does this with just that their universal die roll. And I think D&D does this with its ability to just say, ruling's not rules, right? Like make it up, I guess. Right? It kind of like hand waves over it a little bit, but you're definitely, I think the OSR certainly encourages that kind of play, where I do think something like Powered by the Apocalypse discourages that in terms of, you can do anything, but come up with what you want to do and then figure out how to apply one of these mechanics to what you're trying to do.
This. And, you know, briefly, I'll say that I played in a game of old school Call of Cthulhu. Okay, I did play in two horror games last weekend with our good friend Scott, who runs Rising Phoenix Game Con that we will be at in 2 weeks, and he runs great games himself. And I think that was maybe my most favorite session that I've ever played of Call of Cthulhu. And of course, I actually like that Call of Cthulhu is percentage-based. We can all immediately grab onto that. Yes, there's a giant list of percentage-based skills on my character sheet, but they're all in world. And we were not trying, at least the players at that table, we were not trying to say, can I use my history skill? We were talking in world. I go through the library and I try to find a book that's useful. And Scott, as the referee, was saying, that sounds like a history skill check. So we were not trying to fit this stuff in. We were, you know, playing in the world, and the referee says what, you know, in game on the sheet statistic to use. And I thought that worked perfectly fine as long as the abilities were still in game phrasing that let me think about what's actually happening in the world.
Interesting stuff. Viewers, if you have opinions on large lists of powers, abilities, or skills, variable skills versus standardized, how much narrative structure mechanics do you want in your game? Leave us a comment here in the YouTube comments. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe your thoughts will provoke a new topic for us down the road.
And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, Loops, Twitch, Blue Sky, and we have the handle of Wandering DMs on all of the sites. So please look for us there and enumerate that like button and that subscribe button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so by visiting our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find our podcasts on various third-party podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those third-party sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to a private Discord server where the conversation is continuing round the clock about game mechanics and old school D&D and new school, which we also love, and horror games and science fiction games and all the stuff that we adore all the time. Of course, we're going to be there for our live after chat in about 10 minutes. So we really hope you'll join us there. And if it's the first time, we love having newcomers there every week to get more of your thoughts live, that we, as the chat goes by live and we're passionate speakers ourselves, we probably didn't get everything. So remind us the really great ideas that you had that we didn't pick up on the last 60 minutes. We adore that, of course. And we will be back next week. And we have in 2 weeks, we have a very special guest, Paul, that we're going to keep secret and not tell people about. But we'll tell you next week. We'll tell you next week what's happening in 2 weeks' time. So don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, and we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.